Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
Welcome back to the show. One of the world's top 10 countries in real GDP growth rates for 2012, of them, five were from Africa. Libya topped the list with an astounding 124%, followed by Sierra Leone with 15.2%, Zimbabwe 13%. Ever since, other fast-growing economies include Angola, Chad and the DRC. Okay, get off the floor. Online is the Lorenzo Fioramento, Professor of Political Economy and the Jean Monnet Chair, Department of Political Sciences, University of Pretoria. Professor Lorenzo, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It looks like these figures are what I call bubble stats. There seems to be no context whatsoever.
Exactly. I mean, for the past 10 years, I've been trying to make African policymakers realize that simple statistics of GDP growth mean very little when it comes to understanding the performance of an economy. Many of these countries have basically gone from growing a lot to destroying themselves and growing again. A lot of this growth was actually fueled by crime, war, and natural disasters. This is not something that we can consider positive for an economy, and yet it was behind most of the hype around Africa rising. And so the point of the article you just read is that we should have been very critical of the idea that Africa was rising. We should have actually tried to look critically at the statistics and understand in which cases that growth was good growth and in which cases it wasn't good growth.
Yeah, I mean, Zimbabwe, I can sort of put my mind back to people buying a loaf of bread with a wheelbarrow because their money had deflated so much or inflated so much. Zimbabwe, its economy in ruins, and yet a figure of 13% pops up. So it's telling me, I'm sure you'd agree, that these GDP figures tell us absolutely nothing about the state of the economy of these countries.
I would say so. I mean, GDP has become increasingly anachronistic and obsolete to try and measure the success of an economy. It simply says that people are consuming. And it doesn't say what they're consuming, and it doesn't say where they're coming from. You know, if a country is at zero, of course, even just building one brick is 100% GDP growth. That's not necessarily something to celebrate. If a country has destroyed its economy because of environmental destruction driven past by mining or by oil companies, and then starts rebuilding, of course, that's going to create GDP growth. We have to be able to understand that our measurements of growth really are saying little about the health of an economy, and that we need different measurements, and especially in Africa, where we have seen over centuries and centuries how the development model that was imposed on this continent was mostly based on exploitation of people and natural resources, and shouldn't be seen as a sign of prosperity and success. We should do something radically different.
I mean, the sort of the most classic scenario I can think in the back of my head is a man standing in a field of millets with a hoe, and he uses an ox to plow his field. What on earth is a first world stock exchange going to mean to him? Absolutely nothing. Everything that's meaningful to him is how many millets he's going to harvest for that year. There's just such a discord, isn't there? Such a disconnect.
Yes, and the disconnect has been actually worsened by the excessive blind focus on growth at all costs. If you're a policymaker and all you want is your GDP to grow, you're going to probably open up your market to international companies. You're going to open up your country to foreign direct investments. You're not going to be picky about what kind of companies you're inviting to invest in your country. You're going to be probably very open, and most of those companies will be in for a quick speculative exploitation of whatever you have to offer. And guess what? African countries have got to offer a lot of commodities, a lot of minerals, and those companies may not necessarily be interested in the long-term sustainable trajectory of that growth. So this is exactly what has happened, and this is why the guy plowing the field with an ox and with horses has not been affected by the growth. In some cases, actually, his life has worsened, because now the field he was cultivating is no longer available. It has been polluted by some oil company or even taken away by government together for mineral exploration. So we have to be really, really careful about what we're doing. We have to realize that really the state of an economy is given by the well-being of the people. And if people are not better off after growth, we have to rethink how we measure growth and what we mean by growth. Just to give an example, in South Africa at present, one of the sectors that is driving most of our growth and is employing most people is private security. So in a sense, crime is fueling consumption of security guards, security services, alarm systems, electric cables, and so on and so forth. But that is not an indication of the kind of economy we'd like to replicate around the world. It's more a sign of a social favor that is driving growth. I'd like to hear more and more politicians making these kinds of decisions.
Yeah, me thinks that they're incapable of even thinking economically, let alone even understanding any of its subtleties whatsoever. Excuse my cynicism on that one. I think any sensible person would agree with you that maybe the ultimate sign of a thriving economy would be our man in the millifield being able to afford a tractor or to have electricity or running water. Surely that would be more of a measure of success than the conventional models that we've discussed.
Yes, and you know what happens is that some mainstream economists and some policymakers will tell you, but that's exactly what we want. We need growth in order for that guy to have a tractor, to have some running water, and so on and so forth. Well, my answer is that we need a different type of growth. If our growth is the growth we have seen in the past two centuries, especially in the past 20, 30 years, the guy in the field will never get what he needs. What we need is a growth and well-being. What we need is to support businesses that are really in for the long haul, businesses that are sustainable, businesses that really want to create a better society. And some of these businesses may only add marginally to growth, but they would make a huge positive impact on society. I really want to emphasize that. I'm not against growth. I'm against the kind of growth we have defined over the past few decades. I believe we can now transition to a different model of growth that is really about the holistic impact that economic activities have on society. The type of growth that takes the environment very seriously. You cannot have growth if you're destroying your environmental systems. If that goes without saying, and yes, that's exactly what we're doing. You cannot have growth if you're making the society more unequal. That's exactly what we're doing, however. So a different model of growth would be what Africa desperately needs to uplift people out of poverty, and creating the kind of sustainable development which is the only way out of the present predicament.
Yeah, and of course, another thing which I would say I observe anecdotally in Africa, particularly in a country like South Africa, I'd like you to comment on this, I seem to be seeing two different economies. We see a first world kind of economy, which is reflected in the mainstream banking system and on the stock exchange, and with those who are lucky enough to have excess money to invest, which is a very few. The rest of us seem to be operating in a parallel economy where if you go into a suburb, the one man is garage is selling car tires, the next person is fixing suits, the next, in other words, small businesses seems to be the mainstream of what's keeping people going. I mean, what do you think of that? Two parallel economies.
Absolutely. And, you know, like I put it this way, especially in South Africa, we're obsessed with big is beautiful. We think big is better than small. So we build shopping malls everywhere and we build big infrastructure. We want to go nuclear and we have big banks and so on and so forth. And this is creating all those sorts of distortions you're talking about, right? You know, so you have hyper-consumerism, which is self-destructive in a minority, and the rest of the economy is basically left out. Now, the question is that sustainable development, well-being, is actually driven by small. We should focus more on self-production. We should focus more on communities that are resilient. We should have an economy that helps carpenters, mechanics, butchers, bakers, rather than the pick-and-pays and the supermarkets and the shopping malls we have everywhere. We should have, you know, another piece of information. You know that KFC in South Africa is the main source of food to most South Africans, especially the poor. We call this growth and development, but to me this is a disaster, and it's a serious health predicament which is becoming so widespread. We should produce energy in our homes. We should produce energy in our communities. We should produce what we consume as much as possible rather than buying a very expensive and at the same time very polluting electricity from Eskom. We shouldn't invest in nuclear. We should invest in solar on each and every rooftop. All these things Well, probably add marginally to growth, because when you consume what you produce, that is not captured by GDP, but it has a tremendously positive impact on economic dynamism. That's exactly the kind of development model we need, which at present is opposed by politicians that try simply pursue blindly GDP because they want to be looking, you know, they want to look good by international standards.
Yeah, it's very cosmetic, isn't it? And the model that you're describing of every rooftop having solar energy, collection of water, particularly in the Western Cape where we're having a crippling drought, I mean, it actually boggles my mind that nobody in government has actually encouraged this kind of self-reliance. And what you find in Cape Town is try and go off the grid in Cape Town, and the city council actually gets aggressive with you. They come around and say, "Well, why aren't you using water? Why aren't you using electricity?" Then they want to slap all sorts of levies on you because you're off the grid. It just doesn't make sense to me. I'm being very anecdotal, I know, but I mean, I'm sure everybody listening to us gets the picture.
Yeah, and your anecdotal evidence is pretty much in line with my research experience as well. And, you know, out of sympathy, I need to tell you, I live in Pretoria, and I've installed my PV panels, my solar heaters, and my water harvesting systems in total defiance to the local rules of the municipality, because I believe they're wrong. And especially now, right now I'm in Cape Town about to give a talk, and it's really focusing on the water crisis. And it strikes me that I come to Cape Town, a beautiful city that is on the verge of an unprecedented collapse. And rather than using this opportunity to really rethink what it means to manage water, all I see is punitive measures. All I see is to tell people, stop consuming water, do not flush the toilet, and so on and so forth, rather than saying, wait a minute, what if the water crisis is an opportunity to rethink the way in which we understand using water? What if we can now turn each and every home into a water collector by harvesting rainwater? What if we could turn each and every home into a water efficiency system whereby we, you know, recycle gray water that go into watering our lawns? What if we could actually turn the crisis on its head and making it become a distinctive mark of a city to tell the rest of the world we have learned a lesson, and from now on we're going to be water resilient, even if our levels of our dam levels go back to normal? Because my fear is that we see this as a temporary thing. We're just waiting for the system to go back to normal so we can squander water again as it was in the past. And not understanding that water is an important resource that shouldn't be abused. But of course, if we are interested in pursuing economic growth, guess what? The incentive is to use as much water as you can.
Yeah, you pay for it, so it pumps up the revenue. And of course, as I say, you know, it is very sad because, you know, to talk about the water thing, in 1993, in 2004, the authorities were warned about what was going to happen. And I'm sure you'll agree with me, what golden opportunities were lost to create self-sufficiency, but at the same time, to create a self-sufficient economy as well, so people wouldn't have to be reliant on so many other things. I think that's the crime, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. And it goes back to the initial question about what kind of economy we want. In this country, most of our water is not really used by households. It's being used by mining companies and commercial agriculture, right? And now we want to build a nuclear plant, which is going to be water-intensive, without even thinking that we don't have that water to begin with. So, of course, water is at the core of the understanding of what kind of economy we want. If we want an economy which is more supportive of people's well-being, an economy that is driven by small businesses, decentralized energy production, and so on and so forth, we're going to have better water, more water. We're going to be able to have much more resilient systems. But if we want to continue with this economy of big, this economy which is very heavy on the environment, we're never going to be able to actually fix the water crisis or any other crisis. So the problem with the present situation is that things are interrelated. And rather than trying to see how to connect the dots and realize, wait a minute, you know, the water crisis is actually an economic crisis, we're trying to fix things one at a time and without actually managing to get to a sustainable solution. So I really think, ultimately, the question of what kind of economy should be central to the political debate today. And even to give you a piece of information, you know, a simple soundbite for your listeners, if we had a decentralized energy system in which each and every household was producing enough energy for its own use and or to trade with neighbors, today you wouldn't have all the corruption scandals that are around energy production, the Guptas and coal production and so on and so forth. You cannot corrupt a system that is decentralized. You can only corrupt a system which is heavily centralized in the hands of few.
And that certainly is a very, very valid point. Professor Lorenzo Fioramento, Department of Political Sciences, University of Pretoria, it's a lovely on-air discussing and solving the world's problems. I wish the politicians would listen to us, but thanks a lot for chatting.
It was a pleasure. Have a good time.